Hello and welcome to the 8th edition of Exploring Enterprise, the podcast series from the Enterprise Research Centre. I'm Mark Hart, Deputy Director of the ERC, and today I'm delighted to be joined by Lucy Armstrong, CEO of The Alchemist, an organisation which works with high-growth businesses to accelerate their development. Also joined by Robert Wapshot from the Nottingham University Business School, where he's an Associate Professor in Entrepreneurship and Innovation. And finally, by Oliver Mallett, Professor of Entrepreneurship at Stirling University. Today, we want to be focusing on some of the key challenges for UK enterprise policy as we are beginning to leave the major restrictions of the pandemic behind us. And 2022 has actually produced a whole series of new challenges for us to worry about. And I think that's something which we need to be considering in the context of what enterprise policy might look like. There is an enterprise strategy on the books, which will be coming our way very soon. But what I really want to start with is a piece of work that Richard and Oliver were involved in. And it's very close to my heart because it's all about the Bolton Committee of Inquiry into Small Firms 50 years ago. And it was at that time, as I was a lot younger than I am today, in 1977-78, I was thinking of a PhD topic. And I decided that I would read the Bolton Committee of Inquiry, as you do. It was my first command paper I probably had read properly without having an exam breathing down my neck. And I suddenly decided to do a PhD in small businesses. So this is a topic which was close to my heart when I saw this coming through, and I'm actually delighted to hear that you took on the challenge of writing a new book. So Oliver, to you first of all, and then to Robert, what prompted you to take this on, apart from the fact that, you know, milestones are wonderful things to celebrate? What was the rationale behind this?
Well, I think similar to your experience, Mark, and thank you for inviting us today. I think you can't really study small firms in the UK and not come across Bolton. At least read parts of it. You hear a lot about how influential it was. But I think when Robert and I decided to take a more historical approach to understanding the development of enterprise policy, we really realized how little we actually understood about what the committee had done, you know, where this report came from, the work it had conducted, or how that work had been shaped by the particular context of the time. As of course you know, but many people may not, it was a very, very different time for small firms. We didn't have whole entrepreneurship departments, entrepreneurship programs, journals, academic conferences. There wasn't a huge amount known. And as the committee itself found, even official statistics didn't really get to grips very well with small firms. So it's a fascinating period to look at in terms of trying to take on this agenda. And then historically, to understand enterprise policy making processes, by looking in the archives, by seeing all the government documents, government communications that have since been released that aren't open to the public at the time, you get a really different perspective. And we felt some unique insights into those kind of processes of policy making that maybe we can't get now, but as hopefully we'll come to talk about, we think give us some useful insights for today.
I mean, Robert, can I turn to you and say, look, what was it about the early 70s that prompted this committee to get together and do this report? I mean, the background, I mean, who was it that really set this up? Who was the person who was the driving force behind this? And obviously the early 70s, where we hadn't yet come into the 74 oil crisis, and obviously that rings a bell in terms of the what current events out in the geopolitical landscape. But, you know, can we tell us a little bit about, you know, who decided to do this?
Well, as Oliver's alluded to, it's really important to understand where we were, I think, as a nation towards the end of the 1960s, and where small businesses either fitted or perhaps didn't really fit into that in terms of the mainstream political landscape. So at the time, small businesses were really, I think, viewed as something of an industrial throwback. So we weren't long since after a consensus being formed around coordination, planning in the economy. The mainstream parties were quite agreed on government having quite a significant role in industry and sort of coordination. And also, I think, a sense that in order to recover ground that the economy had been seen to lose in recent decades. So it had been seen as relatively unproductive or uncompetitive against the other major economies. The answers were seen to lie in much larger organizations and the kind of scale economies, scientific innovative breakthroughs that could be achieved as a result of that. And small businesses were seen to really not fit in with that agenda. And there was this sense that government was talking with big business and small firms, which were struggling at the time in terms of things like access to credit and funding, were really being overlooked, if not deliberately targeted by government to sort of get rid of them. And this is some of the views that were apparent within the small business community. And it's at this point, from sort of the mid to late 60s, we see the emergence of a nascent small business lobby essentially emerging and creating pressure in different parts of maybe sort of the conservative political party, within the CBI as well, to really put small businesses on the agenda for mainstream politics. And we can see, looking at the files, that it's really the CBI was playing quite a key role in encouraging the incumbent Labour government at the time to pay attention to small firms and do something about it. And it's really through the work of the CBI here that prompted or agitated for, initiated the establishment of the Bolton Committee. And the rest, I dare say, we can go on to talk about.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I remember, you know, again, my own background looking at industrial economics at the time, it was all about mergers and acquisitions. And, you know, there was really, the economists were silent on the notion of the small business. And what's also interesting, I find, is that, as you alluded to, I think, Oliver, was that, you know, there was no data. I mean, the CBI were lobbying in the back of just probably a lot of lobbying themselves with respect to small businesses, but there was really nothing to suggest that, look, as we now know, that certain small firms are actually responsible for a lot of fast growth, a lot of job creation, et cetera, et cetera. And this is before David Birch's seminal work in 1979 as well. That annoyed me intensely, because obviously what I was trying to do was exactly what he had been doing for many years and I was totally unaware of. But that's just life to being a PhD student. But I think, what were the challenges that were set out in the report in terms of, you know, what needed to be addressed for small firms? Okay, there was no discussion, there was no sense that they were important, but what were the key headlines in terms of the challenges? And I'll come back to you, Oliver, in that one, if I may.
Yeah, so, well, as well as this idea of small business voice, and as Robert said, it kind of came out of early lobbying. So that was one. But I think there's a couple of particularly key challenges that were identified facing small firms. And what we find fascinating is that these are persistent today. So they're different, you know, the context is different, but I think we can recognize them. So two key areas that I'd highlight is one around management capacity or ability within firms. So there's this idea that within smaller businesses, there wasn't the management skills, the management abilities, the management training to be able to effectively lead businesses. And I think we kind of see similar things today in discussions around productivity. Programs, initiatives like the Help to Grow management program that's been launched to try to address some of these issues. And a second one that, again, I think we recognize relates to finance, accessing long-term external finance to, say, support growth, late payments, so from larger businesses. These kinds of issues that were being raised by small firms, their representative bodies, and some of the research that the committee commissioned are things that we recognize today, and we'll still see, I'm sure, people like yourself and Lucy, who are very engaged in this space, aren't going to be taken aback by these types of discussion, but they were really prominent 50 years ago too.
And I suppose that obviously begs the question, what sort of solutions that were being proposed in the Bolton Inquiry? Obviously there was a lot of call for future, for more research, which we know, but I mean, what sort of solutions were being set out? Maybe I can come to you, Robert, on that one.
Yeah, certainly. Well, Bannock, who was the research director of the committee, identifies that 58 recommendations were made. Perhaps the most prominent and significant amongst those was to recommend the creation of a small firms division within the DTI. Now, that's really intended to address, I think, the concerns around small business voice being heard within government, but also to help provide a degree of coordination across government departments around their actions towards small firms and areas of policy that might relate to small firms. Because as is apparent when you go back and look at the archives, things were being done, or things were being done that were associated with small businesses, although perhaps the small businesses didn't always recognize them as policies directed to support them. So drawing together a degree of coordination and cohesion was a really, really important recommendation. And it perhaps has started to form what we would come to recognize as small business or entrepreneurship policy today. Another area that the committee emphasized was the creation of Small Business Advisory Bureau. And these were to feed into the small firms division, really as a way of providing small firms with access to information, signposting supports that were available. And one of the reasons why I think this is important, and it, we have to set it back in the context of the day, is that the committee wasn't strongly recommending, and in fact stepped back from recommending, discrimination in favor of small firms. And this is quite important because as the committee was conducting its work, we saw the arrival of the new Heath government in 1970, very much setting out an agenda of disengagement from industry. So government was to play a less significant role in terms of industry, and actually the size of government was to be reduced. So having recommendations that were not targeting positive discrimination in favour of firms, I think is an interesting perspective compared to where we are today. And I think it also contributed to perhaps something of the underwhelming impact that the committee's report had in certain sectors of the small business and perhaps the business media community. And so some of the attitudes or the views of the committee's report was that the committee had been somewhat complacent in respect of small firms, that it wasn't providing this very positive discrimination in favour of firms, particularly, say, in the area of finance, where the situation was just seen to reflect the facts of life, as it were, that small businesses were going to find this tough and that there wasn't anything fundamentally problematic with the institutional arrangements in place at the time.
Thanks very much, Robert. I mean, plus ça change in terms of anybody who's been working on small businesses for any length of time. Lucy, I'm going to come to you now, because obviously listening to that, I see a wry smile on your face in terms of, oh my God, what have we learned in 50 years? Because here we are, we've got all these challenges, they don't change, and governments seem to struggle with this. So Lucy, what do you react to what Robert and Oliver have been setting out for us?
Well, I sort of can go back beyond Bolton. If you look at the Macmillan Gap just after the Second World War, so we're at 80 years and the same thing. And I think fundamentally what goes on here at a sort of very high level is government is a large structured corporate institution, and small businesses are fluid, dynamic, organic organisations, and they're not homogenous. And so actually it's much easier for government to understand another large structured organization, whether that's a university, whether that's a large charity, whether that's a hospital, than it is another government, a military, than it is to understand something that effectively looks and behaves more like an idiosyncratic family, which many small businesses do, and is driven perhaps more by emotion and reflex rather than process and rigor and discipline. So I think at one level, that is a fundamental misunderstanding. One speaking Serbo-Croat, one speaking French, slower and louder by both parties doesn't mean you understand one another. I think the other issue here is, and this is another one of my little metaphors or whatever they are that I like, is the caterpillar and the butterfly are genetically identical. But when you look at them and see them in their habitat, they look as if they are not related to one another one jot. And I think the problem with small businesses and big businesses is they're both called businesses. If we called them caterpillar and butterfly, I don't think policymakers would have nearly as much problem, because I'd think they'd look at caterpillars and then they'd look at butterflies. But they think they know what a business is. And therefore, they sort of have a merger of the two. And as a result, I think actually policymakers often do a disservice to both types of organization. And by the way, there are more than two, but if we broadly categorize them in those two ways. So I think at a very high level, we just haven't got a common understanding about what we're talking about, or how these organizations behave, or what their purpose is. Again, my experience is there is an assumption by policymakers that every business wishes to grow. Mm. Well, no business wishes to do anything. Businesses don't have wishes. The people who run them have hopes, ambitions, dreams, passions, but they're people. They're not the business. And in a large corporate where you've got this interplay between shareholder power, director power, customer power, et cetera, actually you end up with being able to say something like the business needs to or wants to. But when you've got a small business, so there might be one dominant personality who is both the shareholder, the director, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Actually, the chances of being able to say what the business wants, I think is really slim. So I think at all levels, we just have a fundamental misunderstanding of what a small business is like and can be, and by the way, not all small businesses, and what a larger one might be.
Well, I couldn't agree more with that, Lucy, and I think this is my point about people in government and Whitehall tend to gravitate to things that they can understand, like, oh, a startup, oh, a scale-up, and therefore they wrap policy around that without really having any understanding of what the full spectrum of business, the business population looks like, and what the challenges face. And yes, there are size issues, and Robert's point about, you know, there wasn't discrimination for small businesses. But I think that's somewhat changed a little bit in terms of some of the legislation that's come through and various finance bills over the years. But I mean, do you think Bolton then did us a disservice, Lucy, in terms of actually conflating that notion? And with the CBI lobbying, perhaps that there is the root cause of all of this.
Well, as somebody who used to chair the private business section of the CBI, I probably shouldn't diss the CBI, should I? No,
that's why I asked you the question.
Yeah, exactly. No, I suspect it. Again, who was the audience for the report? It certainly wasn't businesses. And government opines. I mean, a lovely example is when government talks about SMEs. No business person I've ever met calls himself an SME.
Yeah.
But government needs to categorise groups of people. Politicians cleverly recognise that they need groups of citizens to vote for them, and they categorise them. But government only recognises the citizen. So it struggles to recognise any other kind of entity, really, other than another government. And let's be honest, in law, a limited company is a limited company is a limited company, whether it's got 10,000 people or one person. So yes, legally, government's relationship with that other legal entity, that other legal person, you could argue government shouldn't discriminate between them, because actually legally they're identical and they're not human beings. So they haven't got protected characteristics in the way that we might describe human beings as having, or unique characteristics. And so I think I sort of feel sorry for anybody trying to talk to government about a legal entity that counts as a person, but isn't a person and can't be treated in a homogenous fashion. I do think it's incredibly difficult. I think what Bolton didn't help with is, instead of talking about the businesses all the time, would the policymakers talked about setting the context within which businesses are then able to act? And if only they focused more on, if you like, deciding how big the playing field should be and where the white lines are going to be painted and what shape the ball's going to be and how long the match lasts, then I think businesses would be much freer to get on, and those that want to grow, grow, and those that don't, stand on the side and so on, rather than actually, policymakers spend so much time trying to work out what the players on the pitch are doing, they don't realise what they're doing is responding to the framework that government has already set. And if only policymakers thought more about the framework rather than the actors, I think they might have greater impact.
But Lucy, also, I just want to come back in and challenge you on one thing. You say businesses, some businesses stand at the side, but they stand at the side and create wealth and generate wages and generate growth in economies. So it's not as if they stand aside as spectators. They're actually very active.
Some are, Mark. Yes, yeah, some are.
Yeah. But even, again, if it's financial independence for the individuals themselves.
But again, if your government, there are what, is it 5.1 million registered businesses in the UK, of which less than a million have an employee?
Yeah.
So actually, if you're at government level, even that is a very hard thing to get your head around.
Absolutely, yeah.
So, and again, if you're a politician, as opposed to a civil servant, a window cleaner, you and I might describe as a businessman, or we might describe as self-employed. But as far as a politician's concerned, that's a voter.
Oh, it's 5 points. Well, north of 5.5 million, 5.6.
Exactly.
Whereas they don't disaggregate. That's the business population.
Whereas Sainsbury, that has a huge interest in environmental legislation, in employment legislation, in taxation, in all of that, doesn't have a vote at all.
Right.
So politicians, I think, will be thinking much more about the person when they're thinking about a small business, because they're assuming it's an individual citizen who has a vote, whereas big business is actually about structures and processes.
Before I move on with Lucy to sort of look forward in terms of, you know, policy and the sort of recommendations coming out of Bolton and where we are in 2022, I want to go back to Oliver and Robert to just react to what Lucy's been talking about, if I may.
Not to be here as the Bolton defender, but you can imagine, Lucy, when you've spent years reading all this stuff. But I think a couple of things that are interesting, or interesting to me, is that the Bolton Committee in its report really struggled with defining small firm. And what's come through to us is actually the definition, which 200 employees, but is what they were given in their terms of reference. For the committee itself, it differentiated, for example, by sector. Some sectors finding something like, say, turnover, even number of vehicles in road transport, more meaningful. And so I think they grappled with it. And if anything, the failure is not to produce an answer that we could find effective, possibly because it's an impossible task. And I think in some ways, that's what you're alluding to. I think that's particularly interesting. And a lot of things that we maybe recognize today that it struggled with. I think the second thing that's interesting is that, say, for example, on the Macmillan gap and difficulties accessing finance, is this idea that they didn't see a need to tackle that. But at the same time, one of the members of the committee was the GM of the Industrial and Commercial Finance Corporation, that part of its remit was to tackle the Macmillan gap in the first place.
First employer.
Oh, really? Oh,
what
wow.
Became 3i is my first employer. So I'm guilty on all fronts in this podcast. I can see why I'm here.
Yes, indeed. We want to harangue you forever.
There's a lot of things bound up in this. And I think Bolton established in some ways this constituency, not as voters and as you've set out, but of small firms, that then ends up being 99.9% of businesses, so it isn't helpful. But where I find it helpful is that it raises a lot of topics for discussion. So it doesn't provide definitive answers. It doesn't provide definitive way forward. And very soon after, we find that maybe political concerns, wider concerns, mean that they do start to positively discriminate in certain ways. They do start to subsidize support services. They do start to try to intervene to support access to finance. So, yeah, I think it's really that Bolton, for me, starts a lot of discussions. And I think that's probably what Mark, early in his career as a PhD student, was then engaging with, that all these discussions are raised. And I think several of them are things that you've so brilliantly brought to life, Lucy, with a range of metaphors. The only one of which I would finally pick up, sorry, is the playing field one, because that was something that was used and discussed within the committee, where small firms felt that they weren't on a level playing field. They felt that they were disadvantaged in relation to large businesses, that they felt did exercise influence on government and did have certain advantages that they couldn't compete. And that's mangling your metaphor somewhat, but it just really resonated because it was something that was talked about a lot at the time.
Yeah, I would wholly agree with that. A lot of small businesses are rule takers. And arguably that's where someone like the CBI, the Chamber of Commerce, the Federation of Small Business, et cetera, are trying to act as some kind of voice, because small businesses don't have the resources to have the policy team, to have the government relations team that a Sainsbury's, a BP has. But also they don't necessarily have the people inside the organisation to even understand that those things have an influence on how their business is operated. And therefore, when they engage with policymakers, they have a habit of picking on their favourite topic, whatever the latest bit of red tape that really niggles them. And then politicians get a really distorted view because everyone talks about one piece of red tape rather than actually the bigger issue, which is we don't know what playing field we're on. But the one bit we do know, we don't like. So the politician, quite rightly, thinks I'll take that away and it'll all be sorted. But of course it's not. Because the one bit of red tape for one person is a different bit for somebody else.
It can be opportunity, can be lead to competitive advantage. I want to move you on, Lucy, to obviously you work with a lot of growing businesses, the recommendations from Bolton responding to the challenges, which don't seem to have changed at all in 50 years. I mean, what are the key issues that you know, in terms of the detail that you're being confronted with by the businesses you work with?
The bit I personally have never really seen as pressing, but it always seems to be in the public debate, is this focus on access to finance. And the reason the reason I say that is twofold. One is I think a much more pertinent topic is the financial literacy of business people in small businesses. And I casually sort of say British business goes and buys a new factory with a credit card, and then it goes and does the shopping with a mortgage, because it is so illiterate. Also, we have a cultural expectation in the UK that everything is done on debt. And I think that speaks to the Englishman's home is his castle. The idea that I'd rather have the whole of a fairy cake than a large slice of a Victoria sponge that I have to share with someone else. But actually, when you talk to business people who have got the ambition to grow and are employing people and are going into new markets and so on, finance and access to finance is always a derived issue after those leading issues around where am I going, how am I getting there, what kind of people do I need to get there, what kind of skills do I need? Oh, and then one of the resources I require is called money. I then might not know what shape or form of money is best suited to my plan, but they don't lead with give me £500,000 and then I will conquer the world. It's more I'm going to conquer the world this way and then I need some money to help me do it. And that I think gets distorted in the public policy debate, because of course in the public sector all plans are applications for money rather than the other way round. And I think that's, again, where there's a major difference about who's looking through which end of the telescope. And I think that gets lost in the discussion. So that's one area where I think there is a difference. I think the other is this a perception that businesses grow like human beings and they're 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I have met many 50-year-old babies in the business world. And I've also met some very sophisticated, young, big businesses. Mm-hmm. And the things that make the difference between those two groups of people are not money. They're actually about often having a team at the start rather than an individual. They're often about having somebody who has been experienced or exposed at a relatively senior leadership level in that sector before. And notwithstanding my earlier comments about finance, they've nearly always got somebody who is financially literate in the founding group. And by financially literate, I don't mean someone who necessarily raises money. It might be that they are operationally financially literate and they're capable of being a good finance director. And I think that is, so the young big business is just as sophisticated as the PLC. But again, government can't look through companies' house and can't look through the stats to see that, and therefore can't pick them and can't identify them. They tend to be the ones that I think will drive and have ambition and have plans and focus more. But if you are looking at it from a social perspective, of adding value to the United Kingdom, creating jobs, which is a social outcome, not an economic outcome, and creating tax revenue, social outcome, not an economic outcome, then policymakers should want, it seems to me, to take those businesses and help them scale more, grow more, and actually be content to leave the hairdressers and the window cleaners and so on, and leave them to be the one-man bands that they always were and are always likely to be.
Well, having written the case study for Help to Grow Management on Gymshark, that's a classic example of your young, very mature business, but it all came about with Ben Francis, who's now 29. He was 22 when he set up the business in his bedroom, surrounding himself with global experts.
Exactly. Exactly.
Who knew how to raise the finance, and that's where the equity company got involved.
And, yeah, you know, I do think that's a generational shift that is taking place at the moment. And I think it's down to the education system, if I might say so. I'm going to congratulate educators, particularly tertiary educators, who have moved on from the sit in a row, face the front, and you must answer all the questions correctly yourself, to team working, workshops, seminars, modules, i.e. things that mimic the real world. And that is such a shift. And you've now got a generation of entrepreneurs, business people, who have been used to operating and working in a team with complementary skills throughout their school and university career in a way that anybody who's 50 plus has no concept of whatsoever.
Well, the quirky thing about Gymshark, of course, is that Ben did not finish his degree at Aston. He used his enterprise placement year to set up Gymshark, which is probably a testament to the fact that after 2 years, he'd learned all he needed to. I want to come back to Oliver and Robert, obviously, because we're looking at policy. We're anticipating an enterprise strategy. I mean, listening to Lucy and listening to the work you've done on the Bolton report. I mean, do you agree with Lucy that this financial literacy is the key to unlock? And whose responsibility is it? Is that where government policy needs to intervene? Or, you know, I concur with you, Lucy. I mean, the number of small businesses I've come across in the last 10, 12 years I've been doing this sort of stuff on programs, I'm appalled by the level of ignorance that very senior people running very successful businesses present to me. So Robert and Oliver, to what extent, who do you, Robert, to this one? Is that the thing we need to unlock on finance?
Potentially, I think just to sort of go back to Lucy's initial comments around this, and I think reflecting again on the Bolton Committee, it was quite clear then that the concerns weren't just around leadership and management skills, but also this idea of financial literacy. And there was a trope developed of the business owner, a solo business owner, perhaps being this kind of naive craftsman or craftsperson who had known what it was to, I suppose, learn their trade, make a living from their trade, but wasn't well placed to engage with the so-called sort of modern management techniques or to present the business in a way to potential investors that would attract that investment or give them some sense of security or confidence that they were going to see that money again or earn money back on it. So I think that's interesting that has continued in the sort of the smaller business population. I think also turning to one of your earlier points, Mark, around perhaps distinguishing between those businesses which are very much growth oriented and those that are perhaps quite happy doing what they're doing. There is this idea around whether businesses do need to grow and do want to take on the additional burdens and potential risks sometimes of growth. And perhaps when we're talking about smaller businesses and the business population as a whole, it's important that we kind of recognize these two different, at least two different sorts of businesses here. And whilst for various outcomes, we might want to really encourage these high growth ventures, it was still important not to kind of denigrate or downplay the important contribution in terms of the social outcomes that Lucy's alluded to already, that actually those businesses that are earning a living, paying taxes, providing jobs, contribute to the economy. So I think those sorts of things are really important. And even back in Bolton, there was almost recognized pressure for business owners to talk as if they're aspiring to growth, even though they perhaps weren't necessarily sold on that idea. So again, I think there's plenty of parallels over the last sort of 50 years. in terms of where we go next, I think it's a range of things. And I think it's getting that awareness around where to look for different forms of finance, that it isn't always going to be going to the bank for a loan, that there's a variety of different options out there, and trying to provide business owners with sufficient knowledge so that they can make the right decisions for their business and where they want to take their business, rather than trying to present, I think, a set of solutions as if they're going to be universally applicable. We talked about the diversity of businesses. I think it's perhaps trying to equip owners to be better consumers of what is available, rather than almost a never-ending range of things that may or may not really fit.
Okay, thanks for that, Robert. I want to sort of bring this to a head, and I want to go back to perhaps a message from all three of you for those who will listen to this conversation, and hopefully those who are got the pen in their hand drafting an enterprise strategy. So I'm going to come to each of you in turn and say, look, 2022, there's a perfect storm of events that have taken place since the back end of 21. The pandemic is still affecting many small businesses in terms of, as I say, in terms of absenteeism is the major issue at the moment. Hopefully that will diminish as the weeks progress. But we've got issues. The COP26 seems to have been lost in the turn of the year. We've got issues about digitalization and the net zero agenda is really important. We've also got the late payment issue has sort of bubbled up again as a major issue of concern. We've got rising costs for businesses, and we've got this wonderful friction that's happening around our borders in terms of trade and non-tariff barriers, I think, are a major issue for many small businesses. So look, what are the enterprise policy priorities? Your Secretary of State, you're in Paul Scully's, in his role as small business minister, you're in his office. What are you going to suggest to him that he needs to pay attention to? So I'm going to come to you, Oliver, first, and then Robert, and then final word to Lucy, if I may.
Sure. So I think in some ways, building on what Robert was just talking about, I do think there's a big need still for effective signposting and linking of different types of support. So there is, in many areas of business support and opportunities for finance, a kind of market saturation. And I do think that there's a need less for here's more, you know, and it's subsidized by governments, by the government, and more maybe about signposting, but linking between different types of support and building capacity over time. I think, and this relates to several of the areas you were talking about, Mark, and we can see from post-Brexit, we can see in terms of things relating to COVID, relating to things even like absenteeism and employment regulations is, better regulation. And I think what's key there is not just about cutting regulation, but improving it and improving how small businesses interact with it. But I think what's key there is to try to minimize churn. So I think especially post-Brexit, but especially as any new government comes in or any new enterprise strategy comes out and says, we're going to cut regulation, we'll have a two out, one in, whatever, it can create a lot of churn and a lot of uncertainty. And I think one of the things governments can potentially do is create greater certainty and build confidence in small businesses. And especially at times like this, I think that's important. I think that'll be particularly important as we do address net zero. And then the third thing I would say is that while a lot of businesses have had incredibly hard times the last 2 years, a lot of small businesses and entrepreneurs have also demonstrated really impressive innovation and resilience. And I think it's kind of building on the lessons of that and the lessons of resilience, because again, as you've alluded to, we're not going to enter a world where there aren't challenges. We're not going to a world where there's no more pandemics, where there's no more sudden political shifts, where there's no more climate crisis. And so developing the resilience and building resilience while trying to maintain certain areas of stability, for example, in areas like regulation, I think is going to be important.
Thanks very much, Oliver. Well, over to you, Robert, for some final remarks.
Thank you. I think for me, I've been quite taken by my recent reading around monitoring and evaluation. So going back to David Story's work, I know work that you've been involved in as well, Mark. And given the amounts that are spent on supporting this area, I'd like to see sort of continuing efforts to really get clear on the defined objectives and building in, as we're developing policies, building in ways of monitoring and evaluating their effectiveness. So that would be one area. I think to chime with what Oliver's talked about, to give simplification around what's actually on offer. If we put ourselves in the shoes of business owners, we know they're already incredibly busy dealing with a whole raft of issues in their own businesses, let alone the wider external environment. So actually having more straightforward ways of understanding and accessing what's available, I think would be something else I'd like to consider. And also kind of learning on the lessons from the COVID response. I've been taken by Julia Rouse's work on understanding where business support may overlook sectors of society and of the economy. So Julia, you know, has talked around policy being gender aware. And that's because some of the sectors where women have tended to be involved in terms of self-employment were not well covered by the initial responses from government to support businesses through the pandemic. I think that's an interesting line to then follow as we plan our way, hopefully, into a period of recovery.
A period of recovery, calm, and opportunity, I believe, for small business leaders. Lucy, I'm going to come to you for a final word, and then we'll wrap up.
So I'm interested that Oliver and Robert have essentially been talking about the playing field, which was the bit I said earlier policymakers should concentrate on. So I shall now take a contrarian view, which is that government is in, and I think particularly now, in a unique position because of Brexit and because of COVID. Actually, government has a convening power and a leverage over the direct behaviour of business people in a way that is unprecedented in history, perhaps other than over at the end of the war. And I think they should use that. And I think they should use that to do things like anyone that's got a Bibbles or a Sybil's loan and is looking for some deferral or some shift, part of that is actually they need to participate in a programme which might well be delivered by their local university or by their bank, of an action learning set of other business leaders in order to become financially literate. I don't mean everybody has to become an accountant, but I mean that they do have to learn. And I'm struck by Robert's comments about learning. GP practices are a brilliant example. Small businesses, private sector small businesses that are failing the country, failing themselves because they don't know how to run a business, they know how to be doctors. And what they've done is carry on being doctors rather than learn how to deliver a GP service to a 21st century community. And I think government should be using its leverage power. I remember arguing this in the financial crash. The banks were focusing on the bottom 10% of their portfolio that was going to lose the money. And I said, why didn't government suggest that the top 10% that was still performing really well also receive care and attention and guidance and join action learning sets, because then they might grow more and that would compensate for failure, because we end up with policy propping up the failures rather than promoting the success and the continued learning. So I would be focusing on learning, but I would be making, instead of a barrage of learning available and you choose, one of the problems with small business people is they were successful yesterday. And they're successful today. So there is no reason on earth, is there, for them to change tomorrow, because they've been successful. And that's the bit that you have to unpick. And that's the bit that unlocks growth for those who aren't growing. And that's where I think government, I would encourage government to use this moment. Anyone that wants Brexit support, trade support, anyone that's got Sybils or Bibbles, et cetera, et cetera, get into some kind of action learning set with your peer group. Learn from them. Even if you come away with one better idea, you will be a better business person afterwards. And government should be doing that.
Lucy, thank you for that. I think what we've seen today is that the Bolton Report is with us forever. It forms a reference point for all of us doing research and developing policy and working with small businesses. The challenges remain the same. The solutions, which you've aired, need to be developed into coherence to be delivered to our business base. So look, we're past our time, so I would just like to express my thanks to Lucy, to Oliver and to Robert for the conversation. I've really enjoyed revisiting my time with Bolton in 1977-78, so thank you for that. And thanks to all of you listening to the podcast too. If you've enjoyed it, interested in finding out more about the Enterprise Research Centre's work, please visit our website. You'll find a lot more podcasts, many coming up in the next number of weeks and months. And the website address is www.enterpriseresearch.ac.uk. Thanks very much for listening.